All right, here we are in hour number two. Mina Kimes from ESPN going to join us momentarily. But as you know, it is Give 716 Day here in Western New York. Over 550 charities in the eight counties of Western New York being supported by this effort, the fifth anniversary of Give 716. We are nearing $1 million raised, and there is a little bit of an incentive this hour. Here in the 2 o'clock hour Eastern Time, it's the Arts and Culture Hour. If you are one of the first 100 donors of $50 or more this hour, you will have a chance to win a number of arts and culture prizes from around Western New York. You could win a pair of concert tickets to Art Park. You could win 20 pairs of day passes to the Albright Knox Art Gallery. You could get tickets to Greycliff Mansion for a tour there. A pair of tickets at Key Bank Center to any one of the following concerts: Deftones, Jonas Brothers, Goo Goo Dolls. You could get a pair of tickets to concerts at Live Nation Darien Lake. So there's a number of incentives. You got to be one of the first 100 donors, though, of $50 or more this hour. It's 2:03, so get in while the getting is good.
Good stuff. They were talking about this. Announcement, the cultural hour, the arts and culture hour. I could not follow the conversation. I know what.
Yeah.
What did McBean?
Steve's like, what are we doing? I was like, don't worry, I'll explain it.
And he finally he shut up and listened to me. Yeah. So, that.
Like, even if you have kids and you want to get out of the heat, you know, here in the summer, like one of the other ones is five pairs of guest passes to the Buffalo Science Museum, 10 admission tickets to Explore and More. Like, you want to get out of the heat and get the kids inside where they're in air conditioned comfort but can have some fun, make a donation now and you could be one of the winners of those incentive prizes.
Yeah, it's good stuff, and it's just more incentive to, you know, click on and give online now or in any way you can.
Yeah, that's this hour.
That's this hour.
Yeah.
We're watching the number go up as we speak, and we're really close to $1 million now. And
want to get to 1.4 by midnight tonight.
Awesome.
So it's within striking distance. So be sure to do what you can, and as I said earlier, no donation is too small. All you got to do is go to give716.org. And if there's, you know, a charity that's got a special place in your heart, I will almost guarantee you it is on the list, because we got over 550 local charities participating. So if you've got one and you want to see if it's on there, just go to give716.org. They've got the list of participating charities. So be sure to check that out through the course of your day today. We're going to have ESPN NFL analyst Mina Kimes joining us here shortly. I was most interested in talking to her about, you know, her ranking of head coach Sean McDermott on the head coaching rankings. She's got him very near the top. We'll talk to her more about that when we get her on. And actually, she joins us right now.
There you go.
So we welcome in ESPN NFL analyst Mina Kimes. And Mina, we know your downtime is about ready to end because training camps are going to be starting. So thanks for giving us some of what is left of your free time to join us here on the show. And as I was just saying before you hopped on, we know that you are a proponent of Sean McDermott's head coaching exploits. What is it about, you know, his coaching style that most appeals to you?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I think he just deserves a lot of credit for the play of the defense. I'll start there. Over the last few years, I think the Bills defense, you know, they don't have a stud pass rusher the way, you know, like a Cleveland or a Pittsburgh does. And they have really good players, but I think across the roster or across the depth chart, you don't really see that many superstars. Matt Milano at times, perhaps. But when you watch them, they're extremely disciplined. The fundamentals are there, and they always, I think, play almost, I wouldn't say above their talent level, but he gets the most out of the players he has on his roster. You see also the development of players who are drafted outside of the first round. You have some real, really talented guys that Brandon Bean has managed to find later. But I do think Sean McDermott, given that that's his side of the ball, deserves a lot of credit for that. They've had turnover, too, on the coaching staff as well. So you start there. I would also say he gets credit, in my mind, for making difficult decisions. Moving on from Ken Dorsey was a decision that I was dubious of, because the Bills offense was statistically extremely good under Dorsey, but it proved to be the correct one. And then finally, I think as a game manager, he's improved a lot over the years. Sometimes it's hard for defensive coaches to become more aggressive modernized in terms of approaching game management, and you've really seen that with him. So those are three things that come to mind for me.
Well, one of the things that is evident with this defense is you're right. The talent level has – they've overcome it with their ability to get turnovers. And it's one of the things that we talk about on the show is being – it's so unpredictable. One game you go and you don't get any turnovers, and then, you know, you struggle defensively. However, for some reason, this team over the last 4 years has always been a top three, top five team in getting turnovers. I don't know how much credit you can give the coaching staff, but when you ask, they say you get what you emphasize. It sounds a little more simple than it is. And basically, the one thing that did bail this defense out last year was their ability to consistently get turnovers, even with a long track record, 4 or 5 years. Do you expect it to continue?
It's a great question. It's a really important thing to isolate when you talk about this defense. So nerds like me believe that turnovers regress. And when we look for defensive performance regressing next year, that's something that is kind of like a red flag, right? I think I was looking at the FTN Fantasy does this great, it's called the Almanac, and the Bills chapter had numbers. If you took out the Bills turnovers, they were basically an average defense, to your point. But this is a defense that's also, as you said, has gotten turnovers year after year. And I think some of that is stylistic. This is a very zone-heavy defense. It lives in nickel. I think they've got DBs who play the ball really well. And while the pass rush isn't amongst the NFL's best, it's pretty consistent. So the elements are there for them to get turnovers, I think. Will it likely, you know, regress a little bit? Probably. I think you're counting on some of the investments that they made in the draft, particularly on the defensive line, to mitigate that, as well as, of course, improved play at the second cornerback position. So even if those turnovers come down a little bit, and I do think, you know, typically, statistically, that does happen. Hopefully the talent talent that you've added to the roster addresses that to some degree.
Yeah. Talking with ESPN NFL analyst Mina Kimes, who's joining us here. And, you know, you mentioned on defense how there wasn't a lot of elite player talent. And I think they've taken a similar philosophical approach to their wide receiving core. After they traded Stephon Diggs last year, it was clear they made this philosophical shift that they were going to move away from a true alpha number one receiver and just have a collection of very good receivers who, from receiver one to receiver five, there isn't a tremendous amount of talent difference. And all they did was go out and become the first team to score 30 rushing and 30 passing touchdowns in a single season. And when we got past the Super Bowl, they had scored more points than any team in the league, if you count the postseason in there. What do you make of that philosophical shift, number one? Does it have staying power? And should we take anything from the fact that there are a couple of other teams in the league that have taken that approach as well? The Packers, for example. So maybe just roll all that together in a ball for me with that philosophical shift.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We all laughed at the Billy Bean, or just us, Brandon Bean, kind of getting a little bit riled up about the not adding the number one receiver. Yeah, yeah. But I fundamentally agree with him. It was, in my mind, important to focus on the defense. You know, when you think about this team and why didn't they get over the hump, I think about second cornerback being mercilessly targeted in the postseason. I think about the lack of a pass rush. I think about the need to add interior defensive line depth. So his approach to me makes sense. That said, you know, when you run an NFL team in a hard salary cap sport, you have to make difficult decisions. And that is where they have chosen to, you know, you might say underinvest, betting on not only the importance of investing in the defense, but also if you have a dominant run game, a dominant offensive line, and an MVP quarterback, you can skimp there a bit because of that dominant run game, because of the quarterback. Defenses play them in a way where you create opportunities for the receivers you do have. So maybe you don't need a guy like a Justin Jefferson, Jamar Chase, who the defense that you're playing has to completely key in on. I think there is something to that. I still wish they had one. I'm not going to lie. I wish that they had a little bit more speed. I mentioned this on NFL Live. You know, Josh Allen's splits were worse versus man coverage than zone. The Bills face a lot of man coverage. I wish they had a man beater. That's not a Josh Allen stat, right? That's about the pass catchers. But ultimately, given the decisions that they had to make, I think they're understandable. especially given, again, the need to prioritize the defense.
And they do. They have said in the past, it's complementary football. It was a catchphrase for a minute for Sean McDermott, and certainly they play to that. This is an offense that, while he scored all those points we talk about, they were 50-50 almost run pass, which, I mean, that's – you talk. This pendulum swung back drastically from throwing it two-thirds of the time. Is that – a deliberate, you think that's deliberate because of the defense, or do you think it's just part of an overall philosophy?
I think it's
You're trying to shorten the game, you know.
The state of the NFL. I just did a podcast with Dan Orlovsky, my co-host on NFL Live, where we talked about offensive trends and basically how much offenses over the last two or three years in particular have leaned into running the football in response to defenses going lighter, right? Over the last prior 5 years or so, as defenses have gone lighter, as with Buffalo being a prime example, nickel being the new base, there is an advantage to having a team that could just pound the rock, that can get into heavy personnel, that can force run-pass conflict. And I think Buffalo is wise to lean into that because stylistically it is the best offenses in the league right now can run the football. The top four offenses, I mentioned this on the pod, in DVOA, Buffalo, of course, being one of them, were also the top four rushing offenses in football. That's just the state of the league. It doesn't mean it's going to be that way for all of Josh Allen's career because he's so good. You could go into different directions philosophically. Maybe you find a receiver that, you know, a gem, who, and you end up pivoting away and being a little bit more pass heavy. But I think in terms of like where football is right now, the quarterback you have, the strengths of your team, it makes perfect sense.
Dovetailing off of that, you know, we know the Bills were one of the teams that played that jumbo package with Alec Anderson as a sixth offensive lineman almost more than anybody. I think it was around 15% by the time the season was over in terms of percentage of snaps. And now, even though it's kind of under the radar, they have a fifth-round pick in Jackson Hawes, who's more of a traditional Y tight end, and it's got everybody wondering, hey, this is your new third tight end. Are we going to see more 13 personnel, knowing the success the Chiefs have had with that personnel grouping in recent years? So I'm wondering if it even goes another step further. Granted, that's maybe a lot to put on the plate of a rookie fifth-round pick, but, you know, Jackson Hawes is a former Yalie, so, you know, smart kid, quick on the uptake, and finished up at Georgia Tech, which is no slouch of a school either. So I think he can handle it. But what do you think about maybe more teams copycatting the Chiefs to some extent with some more 13 personnel in light of where you think the run game's headed?
Yeah, multiple tight ends is another trend that we're seeing statistically. I mean, 12 personnel hit a all-time high last year. Since we started tracking it at True Media 20 years or so. You know, I have been kind of wanting the Bills to lean into more multiple tight end sets. And when they drafted Kincaid, I think that was the hope. But then, you know, there's health issues. It was him with him and Knox being on the field at the same time, right? And I always think about there was a playoff game, maybe it was 2 years ago, where they used a ton of Reggie Gilliam. And I thought, this is it. It's happening. The Bills are fine. I don't know. You guys would probably know better than But they keep going back to the 11, and I think it would be immensely valuable for them to be able to put three tight ends on the field. Again, when you have a run game as dominant as Buffalo, when you have a quarterback who's as much of a dual threat as him, and then you have, you know, multiple tight ends who can you can hunt mismatches with, it's just going to make the pass game that much more dynamic. So I would love to see that from the Bills.
How many more question marks are there on this roster than there were just 12 months ago? It seems like, particularly offensively, you had a ton of question marks at the wide receiver spot. James Cook was finally going to be the lead dog. You know, Kincaid entering his second season. And now this year, after having this guy, Mac Hollins, we do nothing about. Now this year, the guys that they brought in have pedigrees. They're actually better than Mac Hollins was when he came here last year with Moore and the rest. What do you
think? Joshua Palmer.
Are there more question marks or fewer headed into this season for the Bills?
That's a good question. I think offensively, it's less, I would say, question marks, because you got a lot of solid players. Josh Palmer's super solid. Shakir's solid. The question for me is not like, oh, are there gaping? There aren't gaping holes on this offense. It's more just like, can any of these pass catchers, I think Coleman and Kincaid are the two guys we keep looking at, really take a leap forward and be that man coverage beater that we talked about. Be a guy Josh Allen can lean on to get you a bucket on third down in a high leverage situation in the postseason. Defensively, I think there actually are some question marks. Bosa's health is a question mark. TJ Sanders, can he step up right away? Can he play three downs? What can they get out of him? Where? How do they use him? That's a question mark. Harrison, can he immediately step in? Because he's going to get targeted, right, if he plays. What does that look like? Cole Bishop taking a leap. So there's young players there, and I think that's more where I'm like, okay, I want to see how this plays out before I know how to feel about this defense. Offensively, I'm not worried.
Right. And then finally, before we let you go, I mean, just an overarching view of the AFC East, there's a lot of us here in Buffalo that feel like New England's going to be a much tougher out this year with Vrabel as head coach, May in year two, even though the offensive line there still needs some work. We expect them to be a more formidable group on the defensive side of the ball. And I think we believe that they're going to be the toughest out over the Dolphins and the Jets. The Dolphins seem to have a culture problem. The Jets are in year one under another rebuild. So how do you kind of see this division shaking out?
I mean, I think the Bills pretty still easily clear everybody, right, to be honest.
Right.
I said that last year. It's funny. I think last year I saw a lot of like rhetoric around, oh, the Bills taking a step back. And I remember doing my AFC East pod and being like, no, what? I feel crazy that this is even a conversation. I feel the same way this year. I think this year, you know, there's a lot less skepticism. But and actually, I'm doing previewing the AFC East on my podcast next week. So okay. Bills fans, check that Anytime Show featuring Lenny. But yeah, I guess you're right. I would say the Patriots definitely are a team on the rise. But I think that's a pretty significant gap to close with Buffalo.
Yeah. And then the Jets and the Dolphins. I don't know about the Dolphins. To me, seem just like a team ready to implode.
They're going in the other direction. Yeah. Just some bad roster decisions. It's major holes on that defense, question marks, and the offensive line. Yeah.
Good stuff, Mina. Thanks so much for taking some time. I know you're the season's going to crank up in a minute, and we're all going to be busy, but thanks for taking a minute.
Well, I appreciate it. You guys always ask the best questions. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. ESPN NFL analyst Mina Kimes joining us. And, yeah, check out her podcast next week. She's going to be previewing the AFC East. I mean, We all know that the Bills are the clear favorite, as she just said, but how do things stack up behind them? Who might be pursuing them, per se?
Right.
You know? And, I mean, you kind of just want to know, like, how should we handicap this? Like, we feel good about, you know, the Bills still being tops in the division, but, you know, who do we have to just keep an eye on? Just a little bit.
Right now, why wait? Paul Hamilton on the Wester Hotline to talk about the Sabres schedule, which came out. Paul has written about that at WGR550.com. Paul, what's the most notable thing about it for you?
You know how they really got into those Saturday afternoon games? And they used to really load up on them, especially against Western Conference, you know, far west teams. Because if it's a 1 o'clock game in Buffalo, it's an 11 a.m. game in San Jose type of a thing. They only have a couple on Saturdays, which, I've been reading some things that the NHL is trying to be uniformly a 7 o'clock league.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that had something to do with it. They only have two afternoon games on Saturday. So that was a little bit surprising to me. They have a home afternoon game on a Monday against the Colorado Avalanche on Columbus Day. And later that night, the Bills are in Atlanta to play the Falcons. So it'll be a hockey day around noonish and then a Bills day later on. And there are a couple other Bills, the two others, I think. The Sabres are in Seattle and the Bills are in New England on December 14th and on December 21st the next week. The Sabres are in New Jersey, and the Bills are in Cleveland. So those are really the only three conflicts, the Atlanta game and then those two.
And none of those three is one where both teams are home.
Correct. Actually, they're all on the road except Buffalo home against Colorado, that 12:35 game.
On Columbus.
The Bills are away on all three of them, and the Sabres are away on two of the three.
Did you ever go to two – were you ever lucky enough to go to two games in one day, Bills-Sabres?
So did Kent Hull. I mean, the Bills would play and the Sabres would play at 7:05, and Kent Hull was in his season tickets. He was there. he'd bring, you know, Mitch Farad, or he'd bring guys with him. Quite often, just straight from the stadium right down to the arena. you know, to do it as a kid.
Yeah.
No, that never happened. As a kid, you know, my parents did the best they could, but they really only could take me to one game, so we would decide what game to go to. So it wasn't a situation, and we'd rarely go to a Bills game. So it was just, you know, the one hockey game, and that was it.
I never did both in a day, but at least once my father and I went to Stallions, then Sabres, in the odd. So indoor soccer, maybe 2 o'clock, then dinner somewhere, and then back in for what might have been an 8 o'clock Sabres game in those days. So that was pretty special. A lot of these Sabres schedules look the same every year with like front-loaded home games. There's a lot of road games in December. One thing about this, Paul, before I even thought about it, like, okay, here's the schedule. It looks like the schedule looks. Starts October 9th, ends April 15th. That's about the usual calendar. But it not only adds two more games, but there's the Olympic break, almost a three-week break. It's going to feel like they're playing every night.
We're going to kind of lose the season. I mean, the last game is February 5th at home against Pittsburgh. The next game is until February 25th in New Jersey. So you kind of forget maybe the season's going after a while when it's going to be that long. And you mentioned the home games early and the Sabres. I mean, this, if they want to make the playoffs, they have to take advantage. Six of their first eight are at home. They have to take advantage of that, and they have only four road games in October, and two are in Boston. And the Bruins maybe might not be that good this year. So, yeah, one of the home games is against Colorado, and one is against Florida. I get that, and you can lose at any point. But I really think they really have to be on it in the beginning of the season, and come out of October with a really good record and get this season off the right start if they want to, you know, break this thing of 14 years without being in the playoffs.
I have to remind myself that Boston's down. they're never down, it seems. And so, like, you're saying that, like, oh, yeah. Six out of the first eight, 10 of the first 14, I believe, into the first week of November before a road trip. But it is going to be, I don't know, it's not going to be something that you're necessarily even aware of, but 84 games instead of 82, and they're packed into about the same time frame. It's not like the season's going until May because of the Olympics. Mm-hmm. It's going to feel like they're playing every night.
Yeah. You confused me there.
Well, I mean, they've added two games to the schedule, and you're taking almost 3 weeks out from the middle. So these games have to be packed in somewhere, you know? Like, if you look at January, you've got 2 weeks in a row where you're playing four times. It's going to feel like that.
No, yeah, definitely. It's went with the Olympic year. We really kind of see bad hockey. We'll see good hockey when they come back in February. They'll be flying. Everybody will be flying, but that'll end, and then it's everybody's going to be tired. You're always going to have a team 3-4 or both teams 3-4, and that's just not good hockey, you know, to be watching that.
You're talking about the advantage of playing at home early like that to try to just not get buried or even get a lead, 10 of the first 14 games. I wonder how they'll do, Paul, this offseason in trying to get the building back, you know? I mean, you don't want to have it get to, like it's been so many times, the middle of the season where it feels like they're already dead, and the building can be so dreary when that's the case. Do you think they have a good look at, or any look at, sort of getting fans to an optimistic place so that when they're playing these home games in October and early November, like you mentioned, they can feed off the crowd?
Yeah, I mean, get the crowd going. And Mike, I want to you what you confused me on. It's only 82 games this year.
Oh, they haven't gone to 84 yet?
84 next year.
Okay, sorry.
So I just wanted to correct that.
Well, I can find a couple of open dates where we can add a couple if we need to here.
Yeah, that's what got me confused.
Okay.
when we were talking, and so
okay, I thought that
it's
was
80, it's 82 this year.
All right, it's still
what
true.
What you're saying is right.
Yes,
it's condensed. Because of the Olympics, they have 12 back-to-backs, which sometimes they have 12. I mean, that's not crazy. you know, back-to-backs, and you don't get too many early. You got a really good Toronto back-to-back in October, which is cool. And then you don't have another one until mid-November, you know, when they go to Utah and Colorado. So, and then it takes you to December before you have another one in Calgary and Edmonton. So you don't have really too many back-to-backs. Those are the only back-to-backs this calendar year until you get into January, where it's mid-January where you have a couple. So, you know, I think that helps. That the thing is, back-to-backs, I think, are better early than they are later because you're not as injured, you're not as tired. But they tend to be a little bit lighter on the schedule in normal years, and you don't get quite as many back-to-backs to start the year. And I would think it would make more sense to do it earlier in the season than later.
I wonder if, because of this overall point with the Olympic break, it looks like maybe the league, or at least the Sabres, I'm not looking at the other teams, or at least in terms of the Sabres, there are longer stretches of homestands and road trips as opposed to, you know, two here, two there, three here, whatever, just like breaking it up. You've got weeks where you've got, you know, all home games, all road games, not even traveling that far. I wonder if that has been a strategy here. Just to try to reduce travel in a year where there's going to be, you know, that break again makes it that the games are just more condensed.
Well, they got that six game. The longest one is six games. And you start in Philadelphia, and then you have a day off, and then you play in Winnipeg. And then you have 2 days off, and you play Calgary and Edmonton back-to-back. Then you have a day off, and you're in Vancouver. Then you have 2 days off, and you're in Seattle. So it's going to be a long trip. They'll leave for Philadelphia on December 2nd. They won't get home until December 15th and will have played six games. They also have a five-game trip in there, too. So they have a six-game trip and a five-game trip this year. And then they do have a fairly lengthy homestand also, a five-game homestand in January where they'll be, you know, around. And you might as well in a five-game homestand in March. And as I said earlier, you talked about, you got six of eight to start the season at home. So, and one of the road games is against Boston. So, you know, it's you know, six games is a little bit long for a road trip for an Eastern Conference team, not for a Western Conference team. But, again, I think it's because of the Olympics.
About the fans' point, though, from earlier I asked you about. Like, mm-hmm. we've of course, been through all the different things that have happened. Paterka's trade and the, you know, the Byram stuff. He's going to be on the roster almost definitely, signed now. What's your sense of the fan base's sort of attitude about this? I mean, 14 years is 14 years. Yeah. But do you think the Sabres will have a tough time building up to these early home games where they're going to feel there's going to be some pressure on and off the ice, I think, with these guys to get off to a good start so we don't have another season that feels lost early.
And when I talk about this, I'm not criticizing the fans. It's been 14 years, but it's been pretty toxic around here lately with the fans. I mean, 2 years ago, the players basically declared war on the fans because they were booing them like all the time. One little mistake, and, you know, so they didn't think it was fair. And I don't know if some of the players are even over that yet, but you know how you fix that? Win some hockey games early, just like you said. In the October, maybe you're going to feel some pressure being at home, especially if you start losing, and they'll get on you quick because of what's happened here in 14 years. They're not going to put up with much. So the best way to change what is happening around here is just start winning. You know, win some hockey games. You got 6 of 8 at home. Win 5 or 6 of them, you know? And get off to a good start. Give them something to cheer about. You know, instead of a power play where you never even got the puck in the zone and they're booing you, give them something to cheer about. You know, and like you did at the end of last season, you know, when you got hot. And, you know, of course, there was no pressure on them or whatever.
It was too late, yeah.
Right, it was too late. But, you know, at least they played better. Well, do that in October, you know. And that's how you get your fans back. That's how you get them in the arena. Because they've commented as players that, you know, when they have really good games and the fans really get into it, they're like, wow, the fans were great tonight. Because it's almost like, you know, they put on a good performance and the fans appreciated and the fans really got it into it. And they were loud and they were, you know, booing the referees and they were really into the game. And but to me, that's the only thing I can tell you is just start winning, and you will get your fans back.
Do you expect to be optimistic for them? I mean, these changes this summer, Bulldog isn't here to talk about how they haven't replaced Paterka's offense, you know, but really that's a fair point. Do you expect to be optimistic?
I'm basically just neutral. I like some of the things they've done, but I still don't feel they've done enough. I think for 3 years they've been trying to get a top six forward and failed, and I think that's a failure. But, you know, I still believe that if the goaltending comes through and your goaltending is better than it was last year and you get good goaltending and get the save percentage up and make the big saves when somebody makes a mistake, you bail them out and help them out. You know, that's how you play as a team. You know, somebody makes a mistake, you're there to bail them out. A defense might bail out a forward, or there's a turnover and a goaltender bails out and keeps you in a hockey game. You know, and instead of being down 1-0 because you couldn't make a big save and there was a big turnover, it's still 0-0. All right, cool. Now let's go the other way. But that's the biggest thing. But I still think it's a failure that they haven't been able to get a top six forward. People, you know, like Kevin Adams talked about Benson or Quinn. If we're looking for somebody on the roster who could maybe make up for Paterka, yeah, one of those two guys could, but that wouldn't be the first name out of my mouth. Yuri Kulik would be the first one out of my mouth. You know, Yuri Kulik really made strides last year. This guy can put the puck in the net. He has got a great shot. He really improved his two-way game. So if you ask me, well, all right, if they don't get somebody, who on the roster could help? Yuri Kulik would be the number one name off my tongue, not Jack Quinn or Zach Benson.
The whole thing about the fans, I mean, you and I know well just what Buffalo Sabres, like that energy when they're good, it's way up there. I mean, it's been so long, but when it last was that, you know, the town went crazy. And we're at a point, and I want to bring this up with Brad May, who's doing TV out covering Vegas.
Not anymore.
Oh, he's not?
No, he's been a couple of years since he was doing that.
Oh, okay. Well,
I actually don't know what he's doing. I think he's located in Toronto now, but I don't think he's doing media.
Okay. Well,
unless he's picked something up for this year.
He has had experience with, you know, that scene out there, and we've watched it, and what's happened in Florida. And these markets, I mean, Vegas is obviously relatively new, but the league is different now in this way where – a player, thinking about Briere, right? He's always the first one that comes to mind for me. Just, you know, how it felt like hockey here. You could say that about Fort Lauderdale or Las Vegas or Seattle, right? Where they either didn't exist or we would look at them very differently. And it sort of pushes the Sabres down in this way. It's a tougher thing now to accomplish. This is like marketing players and that kind of thing. But to get those early wins would just be a step, like a badly needed step toward reestablishing that kind of atmosphere, because lately it's just not what you think of. I mean, it's just been so long since they've been good enough for it to matter late in the season and where you get into that sort of playoff mood. So tougher now. We've got new markets and just older ones that have come to life. Florida, most namely. Dallas, even, where you've just got, you know, I think it's pretty impressive and exciting to think about hockey in those places.
Florida was an utter embarrassment for years. They covered the seats up top. They covered them. It was such an embarrassment because nobody was up there.
Yeah.
And then they got good. Now you get people in the building. Carolina. You went to a Sabres game in Carolina. It was like a Leaf game here. It was just like it. And Carolina fans did not like Sabre fans. They did not feel the Sabre fans behaved in their building. I don't know. I wasn't in stands. I can't say to it. But, yeah, now Carolina, they have their own fans in there who are loud and, you know, excited and that type of thing. But that's not the way it used to be. They had to win first to get those fans in there. And Buffalo, which had no problem getting fans in the building getting excited, now, you know, it's – went near the bottom as far as average attendance and that type of thing. So winning cures everything.
And they'll have those early home games to see what they can do. All right, Paul, thanks for your time today.
No problem. Actually, you're talking about Brian Koziol. His son is a really good golfer. I was listening to him at the Porter Cup, and I'm thinking, wouldn't shock me in X amount of years if Brian's son is in the Porter Cup.
But where does Brian always have to tell his kids to put the sunscreen? Like, where do they never think to put the sunscreen? And he's got to be there to remind them. I don't know that answer.
Or maybe his son reminds Brian. Who knows?
Maybe. At least in golf, you don't have to worry about the top of the feet too badly. All right. Thank you, Paul.
Take care.
Paul's appearances on WGR are brought to you by Equitable Advisors. Planning for your future is about more than just money. Let Equitable be your guide, and by Relax Honda. Relax, we got this. Paul's article on the schedule is at WGR550.com. The Sabres own, or I guess NHL.com, the Sabres site, did a nice job today. It's the schedule and the graphic, but also breaking down, you know, chronologically some of the more interesting sections of the schedule. I wonder if, I don't know, it's not that big a deal, but that Olympic break, and we're not stretching the schedule out, keeping teams at home for a week to mitigate more of the travel. I don't remember the schedules quite looking like this, where five home, five away, you know, like we talked about a little bit there. That happens two or three times during the season.
Best part of the week. Shayna Goldman from The Athletic is with us here on Sabres Live. How many words have you written already, Shayna, on this year's schedule?
Zero. And I'd like to say I'm going to keep it that way, but I'd be lying because I do know it's a part of my story next week. But I think it's so odd how obsessed everyone is with the schedule coming out. Like, it's different for football. I get it. We're all bored, but like, go touch grass, go in the pool, go to the beach, go to a lake, do something.
Yeah, I get it, but I'm excited about it because I want to like see where I'm going to be on New Year's Eve. Am I in studio? Am I at the arena? What's going on? Like, you.
That's fair. See, you have a reason.
I know, but I also, and I get maybe like you're saying, like when the Bills schedule comes out here in Buffalo, I'm all over it. Like, I want to see the schedule release video when they play. I put it in my calendar. That's priority. Priority is there. But I think it's fun. I like some of the videos. I was telling Duffer and producer Jeff, I love what the LA Kings did. I love what the Sabres did.
Sabres awesome. And Kings are the best. Like, yes. It doesn't even come close. The Kings was actually, I love the Freddie Beers guys, so I was like biased. And the Sabres, like, we were texting about it, Allison and Sarah and I, like, going through some of the better ones. And that one, like, was our first, like, wait, this one is really funny. Like, it was unique. And it was, yeah. I don't know, I was, like, you can scroll through it quickly. So I like that, too.
Yeah, no, it was good. But, okay, well, since you're not, you haven't written any words on it, but you do have strong opinions.
Me? Strong opinions?
You strong opinions. So I felt like there's more, and I don't know if it's going to be like that across the league, but the Sabres have more Wednesday night games. Do you feel like the league is going to stop doing 14 Tuesday, 2 Wednesday, 14 Thursday, or is it still in the cards this year?
It's still in the cards. That is the one thing I did scroll through for. I was like, you know what? Let me take five. Let me just take a quick look. And that's exactly what I look for. I wanted to see the balance. And I saw a couple weeks where it's like, there's five games on a Wednesday, five on a Monday. Cool. Progress. But like opening week, there's zero on Friday. So they could have 16 on the Saturday and 14 on the Thursday. And it's like, listen, we don't need to do this because this year, the issue is they are shifting more towards 7 p.m. starts, right? And that it seems like that's something they want to be the standard. And on a weekday, I understand it. On a weekend, I totally disagree. I think it's like the perfect opportunity, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to go on the half hour. So you have a better, you know, staggered schedule and you can watch more. But if you're going to stack up the sevens, then you need to spread out, you know, throughout the days of the week more. But there's this idea that fans don't want to watch other teams. And I'm sure the data backs it up that fans primarily watch their own team, but there's a reason for it because it's impossible to watch other teams when your team overlaps them on 3 days of the week, the only 3 days a week we're allowed to play games, right? So you can't because you're just jumping around intermission to intermission instead of watching the games, and not everyone can, you know, manage to stay up past 9:30 when their home start ends to watch, you know, Utah or LA or something like that. And the problem is too, like when you do have those couple national nights, the scheduling of the national night sometimes, it's not the most exciting games. Like, if you want to get people's attention, I would think you would load up those Wednesdays and Fridays with things like Colorado-Edmonton, right? Like, that's a game, if it's on TV, I think we're all watching it, right?
Surely you must have a thought on Blackhawks-Panthers, 5 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Yes.
Okay. Biased here. Like the 5 p.m. start. Like the, it felt like a soft launch last season. When
they're the two-time defending champions. Why are we burying them at 5 in the afternoon on Tuesday? Thing.
It's like assuming they're going to get the views because they're the Panthers, and then you give them the Blackhawks so you get your big market, small market. But to me, that is not the way to do it. Like, in a perfect world, to me, you're not giving the Panthers Oilers on day one. I know a lot of people on that Stanley Cup rematch. I don't. I think that's a mid-season, late-season thing when they're both, like, in form. I want to see them go head-to-head there. But I would like to see the Panthers' opening matchup be someone they took out along the way, so you have that spite to fuel it. Perfect world? It's Toronto, because you get the best of both worlds. You're getting a big market. You're getting the Leafs. But then again, Leafs, Habs would slap opening night for them, or Leafs, Vegas. Like, there's other ways. So why not go with one of the other Florida teams, right, who they took out along the way?
Carolina.
Or Carolina, exactly. Like, yes, you're going small market head-to-head, but I feel like it's just looking at it the wrong way. Like, I get the business perspective, but I think more interesting is the rivalry perspective. Like, that, if you're the NHL and your platform is the game sells itself, you don't need to market it because the game sells itself, then you better sell it with something interesting.
Bo Byram signs a two-year deal. We've talked about... We went to bed Monday night. I was so excited when it happened because I was like, yes, we got a huge topic for every day this week, and we're going to have Shayna on Thursday. So 2 years, six and a quarter each year. They avoid the team elected arbitration. Duffer asked me at the start of the show, because fans still ask, does that make Bo Byram more tradable? I said he will 100% be on the roster game one. And that's not somebody you're trading right now. But Shayna, you have opinions. What do you think of the deal? And does that make him more tradable, less tradable? Is he part of the solution in Buffalo?
I have issues with the timing of the signing, unlike you, because, see, I wrote my entire column by that point.
Sorry.
Filed and done. And there was a Bo Byram section in it on the fact that the market has changed for him. And all of these defensive sections were all based on that. So I had to get to work quickly and scramble to change it. But I digress. Okay. I think
and it was at 10 o'clock at night. So you're like, that needs to be changed.
I thought that was the day. Yeah. I think the contract definitely makes it more tradable because I think it gives him cost certainty, right? And it's not in the highest range it could have been. I think, say the Blues wanted to make a deal this summer and there's that potential of signing him for $9 million, I think that might have scared away a lot of teams, just like the Sabres weren't willing to give him that yet either, because I think he has to show he can be a top four driver. And he hasn't done it yet, right? In Colorado, he didn't have the chance. With the Sabres, he's primarily with Darlene. He's very good with Darlene. And then when he wasn't with Darlene, it wasn't as good. So, you know, you have to see what he can do in his own right. And it's going to be difficult because obviously there's power in Darlene in the top four already, who are generally the drivers of their own pairs. But it's a good way for him to prove what he can do, and the Sabres to see what he can do, and the rest of the league to see what he can do, right? So if there's that positive feedback, it will show the Sabres maybe they're more willing to, you know, sign him, or another team is more willing then to say, okay, we will make that next bet on him for $9 million. Or if the trade happens sooner, okay, we'll bet on him at this price for 2 years. I think that's always a good thing to have, especially when we saw some of the defensive contracts, like they really spiked this year, this offseason, right? You're seeing the money that Provorov gets, and Kendra Miller made a lot of money. Like, these are Cody Ceci and Tumulin. Like, these deals.
And Gavrikov, although maybe not as much for him, but still a big contract.
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to raise the price for someone like Byram, just kind of like it did for Dobson, right? Like, that RFA defenseman who's going into his prime or in his prime years, there's this benchmark for it. So I think the fact that he's not at that benchmark and it gives teams a chance to assess his game a little bit more in a different way is a good thing for everyone.
With that deal being done, do you believe the Sabres still have another move in them before this season? Because, as you know, the attraction to the Byram situation for fans was, you sign him and keep him, do you move him to get a part up front after you dealt Paterka. But if you do that, what does the back line look like? So a lot of people are still very much wondering, like, if this is how it's likely to look on opening night.
It feels like at this point it might be, but I would like to see one more deal. I think the Sabres are at a point where they can afford to trade draft picks without worrying about it, right? Like, and you see that already. Montreal was willing to deal two first-round picks to bring in Dobson. A team like Ottawa is willing to move out picks when they have to, because you, as many 17 and 18-year-old players you want to draft and have, and that's going to help you extend your window, you need to open that window in the first place. So you need more players ready to compete right now. I think that they should make another move for a top six forward. I think that would take them up a notch. And then you still have the room to make moves down the line. And if you're an opposing team right now, I wonder if you could look at it and say, okay, you know, if you are you more willing to take that Sabres pick for 2026, which is a deep draft, right? Versus 2027, 2028, when ideally the Sabres are back in that playoff picture. So I wonder if this is like the right moment for that to happen.
We will have, and hopefully have, Bo Byram on the show tomorrow. So last time we had a guest later on the show, we asked you for one of your questions. I think it was with Jarmo Kekalainen, and you said would taking a year the time off help, right? And he said, absolutely. So what would be your question to Bo Byram? And we'll make sure that we pose that to him tomorrow.
How does he feel he has to adjust his game when he is or isn't playing with Dahlin? Because that was a big topic this year, right? Like, Dahlin's the driver and is so good at retrieving pucks in his own zone, which allows Byram to kind of cook up the ice. So what is, you know, how does he have to look at the game a little differently when he doesn't play with him?
Okay, wrote
Your
it down.
Your Athletic is reporting that Igor Chinnikov has requested a trade from the Jackets, and that's not surprising entirely based on how last year went. He wasn't 100% healthy and obviously had some challenges being what he once was with Dean Evason behind the bench. Dean obviously did a terrific job keeping Columbus so close. But what do you make of Chinnikov, the player, and his value across the league at this moment?
I think teams should be very willing to jump on reclamation projects when they come around, especially when it comes with a low price tag. I think we've seen a couple teams kind of nail that. The Capitals are a great example of it. And I think even the Canadians, to an extent, you know, they've done it with guys like Doc. And whether or not it's worked out is another conversation, but it's the swings you take. So when you have the chance to do it for a player that's in their early to mid-20s and they don't make a ton of money, it's a really great chance. I know sometimes it's viewed as, if a player strikes out here, maybe there's a reason for it. And sometimes there is. But I think that there's a way to give someone another opportunity, another chance. So I think that contenders could afford to do it because he's cheap. But I also think that those teams in the middle are the most interesting to me, because I think they're the ones that should be taking that risk and should be taking swings.
Is he a top six? Because, I mean, he's probably a 40 to 50 point guy. Like, I know he only played 30 games last year, so that puts the number pretty low at 15 or whatnot. But is 45 to 50 point enough to be a top six? Or do you think it's more of a middle six, like third liner?
I think middle six, right? Because at his worst, if he's a third liner, if you're a good team and he's on your third line, it says something good about you versus him not being up, you know, up to the level to play. But if he can have that leeway to jump to the second line, I think that's probably where his ceiling is at.
What else, from an individual standpoint, is still percolating for you around the league as far as, you know, someone's next place, someone's new role with a new team? What are you looking at?
I'm interested in the teams that lost big players and didn't replace them. I'm very interested in the Leafs and the Jets, because I think the Leafs offseason, if you take Marner out, and Marner is a big piece to take out, right? I think if it's like in a vacuum, the Marner situation, everything else, they've done pretty okay otherwise. I think that they're taking a better direction than they did last year, right? Like, going for Michelli kind of shows that, because he's smaller and he's not this like playoff pedigree kind of guy, or that playoff style that you think that you need. So I'm just interested to see what they do to actually replace Marner. And same goes for the Jets. They've been a little quieter this summer. Obviously, they signed Jonathan Toews, got a lot of headlines. And they still have, you know, Vilardi to extend and Sandberg. So getting a better picture of the cap is going to help once they get those contracts settled. But I feel like I look at them and I go, you took a huge step back at the end of the day without Ehlers. Like, you didn't replace him, and they have cap space to work with. So I am curious if those teams are going to do anything else or kind of go status quo and then adjust on the fly.
So the Sabres, the biggest thing when we talk Bo Byram is about keeping pucks out of your net, playing better defensively. They have Luukkonen and Lyon. Devin Levi is still there. Kevin Woodley at the NHL on NHL.com. And I love Kevin Woodley with his goalie work and the prep that he puts in. He puts a list of the top 10 goalies 24 and under, which Devin Levi fits in that description. Levi is 8 on his list, behind players like Levi Marilainen and Jacob Fowler, Trey Augustine, Jed Greaves. Should we be a little bit worried in that the fact that it's starting to trend the wrong way a little bit? Levi had a good year last year in Rochester, but the expectations were so that he should have been in the NHL, and for 2 years now he starts in the NHL and it doesn't stay there, that he's dropped behind guys that have played 10 NHL games, 0 NHL games. Like, is that a concern to you, or is it, nah, like, shiny new toys always get put higher on the list, and Levi unfortunately dropped, but he's still a quality guy?
Yeah, the latter is kind of my take. Like, the shiny new toys are going to get the attention because they haven't had the chance to fail at this level yet. And I know that comes in as a very pessimistic view, but teams don't understand goaltending and goaltending development. It just isn't understood around this league, right? Yeah. And that's why we see most goalies aren't even trusted to play key roles until they're a little bit older. Like, UC Saros coming in, he was like, what, 21 years old behind Pecorine? Like, that is the exception, not the rule. A lot of the times these goaltenders, they come in too early, they get overhyped, and then if it doesn't go perfectly, everyone's worried their career is tanked instead of giving them a chance like they do everyone else. Now, I don't necessarily agree that a goalie isn't ready to be the guy until he's 27. Like, I think that it's just this, like, hesitant approach, but I'm not there yet. Because a lot of teams want their goalies to cook first. I think Levi just came in with too high of expectations, so now these guys are going to face it, and we'll see if they sink or swim, apparently.
Do you think Shelops will, in fact, emerge as the go-to guy for Pittsburgh this year, and do you think Edmonton will ultimately do something with their crease?
I think Edmonton will ultimately do something with their crease. I don't think Tristan Jarry is the answer. I think that he adds the instability that they already have, and his playoff pedigree isn't there. And I think sometimes playoff pedigree does get overhyped, but I mean, it does matter if you're in their position, right? You're not a team trying to make the playoffs with him. You're a team that's trying to go further than years past, which is actually winning in the Stanley Cup final. So I would be staying away from that. I just don't think he's reliable enough, but I think Pittsburgh is going to make a change in that. I think it's going to be Blomqvist and Shelofs. And I like Shelofs so far. I think he was very good for Vancouver, not this past season, the year prior, and into the playoffs. And I think he handled the chaos very well there. And I think his growth in the AHL is another step forward for him. Is he a true starting goalie yet? I don't know. But if he could be, you know, share the net on a rebuilding team, I think that's a good stepping stone. But I am curious about other situations similar, because I feel like someone like Shelofs, like, he could have gone to an Edmonton. So who else has a player like that they could target? Yeah.
Do you think, so you mentioned Blomqvist and Shelofs in Pittsburgh, so you think Tristan Jarry would be waived at the end of training camp, as $5+ million for 3 more years would be buried in the minors? Well, I mean, they'd still be on the hook for about $4 million of that on the cap. But so you really feel that Pittsburgh, even though Jarry came back at the end of the year last year, that it's no, we would start with a couple of young kids and go in that direction?
I kind of think that's the move, because I don't think those kids should be in a 3-goalie situation this early in their career. I feel like that's just not beneficial for anyone. You've spoken on that a ton. I wonder if Jarry makes more sense for one of these rebuilding teams that needs to get closer to the cap floor, right? Like Anaheim and San Jose have a ton of cap space still. And, you know, you can let him be a 1B to their, you know, that next gen goalie that they're bringing up. They have Dostal in Anaheim, but you know, you had John Gibson. Do you want someone who maybe takes up a little bit more cap? So I'm not sure maybe they're the perfect example, actually, because Dostal is going to get money this summer. But you look at San Jose, you look at Chicago, and I wonder if one of those teams actually would make some sense for him.
Mm-hmm. What's your next big event? Concert, sporting event, whatever.
Slammiversary.
Nice.
I'm going to on Sunday, actually.
Oh, okay.
Where?
It is at UBS.
Perfect. Oh,
My favorite arena in the whole wild world. We were just talking about it.
Listen, I went to a wrestling event at the Coliseum, and it was they had like one concession stand open, and I waited online for bad popcorn for like 30 minutes. Oh, no. So if this can be better, I'm all for it.
And not that I think the Coliseum was like the, you know, but I feel like it had a little bit of an identity and some flair to it, and it was unique. And I feel like UBS is just like
it was a whole arena. Like you went there, and maybe it's because I've been going there for so long, but it had that homier vibe. I agree.
Yes. No.
Shana, I definitely thank you. Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks. You too.
We'll see you next week. Shana Goldman from The Athletic.
All right. Hour number two on a Thursday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you, and pleased to be joined now by a man you see on NFL.com. You also see him on the Move the Sticks podcast. It's one Bucky Brooks joining us here as our downtime is just about over, Bucky, because training camps are starting quickly. As a matter of fact, they've already started in a couple of places. But thanks for giving us some time. We appreciate it. Wanted to begin with one of the recent write-ups you had on NFL.com about some players that you believe are going to break out in 2025. And for the Bills, you picked Keon Coleman. I don't know if this is because you too were once a second round pick of the Bills, much like Keon Coleman, but maybe just enlighten us a little bit as to what has you bullish on Keon in year two.
Most of the improvement that guys make, the biggest jump is between their first year and second year. Coming into their rookie season, there are a bunch of unknowns. You don't really know the NFL game. The team doesn't fully know you, your strengths, your weaknesses, and all those things. It's one thing to speculate and evaluate. It's another thing to have you in the building and to watch. Now that everyone knows and is on the same page, you can really make some targeted development in terms of certain areas that you want to improve upon and those things. And so for Keon Coleman, being able to settle in and being a dominant receiver on the outside, as Josh Allen becomes more comfortable with him and looks to push the ball down the field and lean into the things that he provides as a red zone weapon, a jump ball specialist, to me, I just envision Keon Coleman having a bigger role, having more production, because his teams lean into trying to slow down Khalil Shakur and some of the other guys. Keon Coleman is going to win those one-on-one matchups on the outside.
So we got last year at this time, the Bills were expected to take a kind of a massive step back. You thought the Jets would be better. You thought the Dolphins would be better. And I think they exceeded expectations, obviously, last year, particularly offensively. What are you surprised, or how big is a surprise, and how much better could they be with this stable of wide receivers? I mean, Mac Hollins is a good player, but Elijah Moore and Joshua Palmer have a little bit better pedigrees than Mac did coming in. They had to make a midseason trade for Amari Cooper to kind of bolster him up. How much higher expectations are there for this team just because of particularly what they proved last year in a year where they were supposed to take a step back and got to the conference championship?
Well, I think a lot of it, the expectations go up now because Josh Allen played at an MVP level. And what's funny is, right, we talk about him being one of the great quarterbacks in this league, already regarded as elite. Some would say maybe he is QB1 in the league. He took a cast of unknowns and unheralded playmakers and got this offense to play at a high level. You would think that when you add in more weapons, more firepower around him, this offense would go to an even higher level, which is kind of crazy to think an offense that is hitting 30 points each week can even improve. I think the big thing is this offense goes as Josh goes. And as Josh has really matured into not only an elite player, but one of the best leaders in the league, this offense follows his lead. And I just think the sky is the limit for this team just because they're so talented. The quarterback is really good and he's wired the right way. To me, that consistency that you see from the team and the offense, a lot of it has to do with Josh Allen and his maturation process.
I'm curious for your thoughts here, because we saw more 12 personnel from the Bills last year. We even saw a lot of that jumbo package with Alec Anderson on the field as a sixth offensive lineman or a jumbo tight end, whatever you want to call him. But Kincaid was hampered by injuries last year in year two and took a big step back in terms of production. Would you be shocked if you saw similar breakout production from him in the way you're expecting from Coleman?
I would not. Last year when we had the list, I had Kincaid on the list because that was the expectation that he would break out. He had a great rookie season, and so you naturally expect him to kind of build upon it. It didn't happen the way they wanted to, but what they did is they found other aspects and other facets of their offense that would make him even that much harder to defend in 2025. The thing about Kincaid and Knox and going 12 personnel is it really puts the defense in the bind. Do you play regular personnel and deal with the linebacker having to match up with one of those tight ends? Or do you put nickel in and then they run you off the field with James Cook and right. others in the backfield? It is a way for Joe Brady to dictate the terms to the defense, but then to continue to stay one step ahead of them in the chess game. I love what it looks like, but I also like the fact that they've upgraded the wide receiver room. They really can attack you in a bunch of different areas, and the best offenses can get at you in a few different ways, and the Buffalo Bills certainly have a bunch of different avenues where they can attack.
One of the other things that interested me in your content and all the stuff you've been writing about was the five NFL teams that really won the offseason. And I know that's it's a little bit of an esoteric title, but there are some teams who really did some things, and a couple of them really mean something to the Buffalo Bills, one of which, of course, is the Baltimore Ravens. You had them, and you've got some high expectations for the Ravens, I read, and also the other one are the New England Patriots. I know you also had Chicago, Washington, and the Raiders on that list as well, but focus on the Baltimore Ravens and the New England Patriots, because those are two teams that are right on the front burner of the Bills' season.
Well, obviously, you know, we talk about, like, even though they're not division rivals, they're conference rivals, and some of that rivalry stems from the fact that the quarterbacks, same draft class, a lot of similarities in terms of their level of success. Both have won MVPs. Both have won a significant amount of the game since being starting quarterbacks. And we all know that the road in the AFC requires you to go through the gauntlet of quarterbacks. And so the Ravens always have their eye on the Bills. The Bills certainly have their eye on the Ravens. They've upgraded the roster, and I would say they have a little older roster than the Buffalo Bills. And so it feels like it's a now and never situation for the Baltimore Ravens in terms of going all in to try and make that elusive run at a title, because they've added the firepower. You bring in DeAndre Hopkins, some of the other guys that they brought in via the draft, they should be ready to go. And so there's a lot of pressure on them because they made the upgrades, even with Jaire Alexander coming over. But can they play their best ball when it matters? We've seen them run through the regular season time and time again, but we know the game is different when you get into January and February. Can they execute at a high level despite having one of the best rosters in football?
You touched on that influx of youth, particularly on the defensive side of the ball for the Bills. They are unquestionably a younger defense than what the Ravens are fielding this year. I don't even think that's a debate. We've seen Sean McDermott and his staff excel in player development, and not every organization in this league has that. And so while I think we can say, at least from this side of the television and radio, that there is more talent on the defensive side of the ball, there's some potential to be reached with that group. The Bills have shown an ability to pull that kind of stuff together. They did it last year with a big turnover on the roster, granted with not as much youth as they have facing them now. What do you think is realistic for McDermott and his crew on the defensive side of the ball to pull a lot of that youth together and, in a couple of cases, get them on the field early, knowing you have a Michael Hoyt and a Larry Ogunjobi serving six-game suspensions at the outset?
Yeah, the one thing about the Buffalo Bills, they've been very, very consistent. And one of the things that helps them when it comes to development of young players is the continuity. Not a lot of staff turnover, not a lot of turnover in the building. And so everyone sees the game through the same vision. So the players that are brought in, Brandon Bean and company, bring in the right players. And Sean McDermott is not afraid to play the young players. The system is a sound, solid system. It allows young players to jump on the field because they can play and play freely. And I'll just say this, man, there are different levels to it when it comes to coaching. And you have one of the best head coaches in the game, Sean McDermott, who has a really, really good staff. He's hard on them, but man, they get the best out of their players. And when you have a staff full of teachers who embrace coaching young players, that's when you get the best out of those young players, because coaches can do one or two things. They can complain about what the players can't do, or they can get the work and really focus on what they can do. The Bills prefer to do the latter. They put these guys in a position to succeed. That's why they've been so successful the last few years.
So at this time of year, we're on the cusp of finding out exactly which of the new head coaching hires, you know, the three, Ben Johnson, Aaron Glenn, Mike Vrabel back in the league at head coach. Which of the new play callers and the quarterbacks, which one do you think, you know, which situation do you think has the most potential for hitting it right away?
Well, going around the league, everyone's going to say Chicago because of Ben Johnson having an opportunity to go with the number one overall pick. It's still a wait-and-see situation because this game is not just about collecting talent. It's putting together the right team. And so can all those puzzle pieces fit with Ben Johnson being your first-time head coach and play caller? That's a lot to manage at one time, managing the team and trying to get your offense right. But I'll say the one because we talk about the division. And I didn't talk about it earlier when you asked the question, but the New England Patriots, Mike Vrabel bringing over Josh McDaniels to work with Drake May and what that looks like, because it's a brand new roster that he's inheriting. And anyone who knows Mike Vrabel and the teams that he had when he was in Tennessee doesn't look aesthetically pleasing in terms of what they have and how they play, but you're always guaranteed to be in one of those fourth quarter battles. They're going to make it tough on people, even though they may not be the most talented roster. They're going to be very competitive. And then the other person I'm going to talk about is Aaron Glenn with the Jets. Aaron Glenn being a part of that startup, that makeover in Detroit, taking those lessons and the Bill Parcells stuff that he learned along the way as a player, coaching. The Jets team are going to be a tougher team. So this division becomes very, very difficult because you got really good coaches. You have gritty teams. And look, when I went to Buffalo in 94, I'll never forget seeing all those division banners hanging up there and that team being the envy of the division. Well, it's back. And so the Bills have a target on their back. And so they have to gear up to deal with the defenders that are coming in that division.
The one team in the division you did not mention was Miami, Bucky. And this is the last one I'll have for you. I don't know if you can characterize them as a gritty team. As a matter of fact, some former players from that team who now play elsewhere weren't afraid to characterize the team as soft even. Mike McDaniel appears to have a little bit of a culture problem in terms of relying on player-driven leadership there. And two of their best leaders, Javon Holland and Teron Armstead, are no longer there. How dangerous and how much on a tightrope could Mike McDaniel be this year? Because two or three game losing streak there, I wouldn't be stunned if that team completely implodes. How worried are you about their prospects?
I'm worried because all the things that you hear about the Miami Dolphins are troubling. When you talk about players and the culture or the lack thereof, that stuff is hard to overcome when you want to play at a championship level, which is what they have title aspirations. And then when you have a mass exodus of players, which sometimes addition by subtraction is good, but they're not the same team. And you couple the fact that they play like a warm weather team that can only play in the comfy confines of being in South Florida. Well, that makes it very, very hard to go on like a serious title chase when you think about all the good teams and where they're located and how they play. To me, the Miami Dolphins, first, they have to embrace a different style in terms of they can do the fun and gun stuff that they like to do. But at some point, this game is still a physical game. And even the most finesse teams have to be able to turn it on when we get into December and January. Particularly, if you're going through Buffalo, you're not going to be able to throw the ball all through the air. You're going to have to be able to get rugged. You're going to have to play a style that, look, most teams have to adopt when you get to playoff football. And right now, the Miami Dolphins aren't constructed to play that way. Maybe it changes over the course of the year, but right now, they look like a team that's on the outside looking in.
Last one for me, Bucky. We all know Josh Allen MVP, Lamar two-time MVP, Mahomes, even Saquon Barkley was in the conversation a year ago. You have a dark horse for somebody who might step up and say, oh, my gosh, that guy's actually playing at that level. Anybody who's off our radar that may bust out like that to that extent?
Well, I think the guy that you have to talk about potentially being an MVP would be the young quarterback that took the league by storm last year, and that would be Jaden Daniels. When you think about the Washington Commanders and what they were last year, the fact that he was able to help them get to 12 wins and an appearance in the NFC title game, man, that puts them squarely on the radar. And then you think about the upgrades. They take a former Buffalo Bill and Von Miller, add him to a defense where they're looking for him maybe to be a closer to turn back the clock. But Jaden Daniels is someone who, and I'll say this, and I'm really being honest, like he might be the best dual threat quarterback that we've seen enter this league in terms of being a dynamic runner who is also a polished pocket passer. It's different to do the things where you're more athlete than quarterback, but he is a quarterback who is also a great athlete, led the league in yards per rush, second in scrambling yard. I mean, this dude is terrific when he escapes the pocket, but he also has the poise, the patience, and discipline to deal from the pocket. Talented quarterback who has upgrades on the outside with Deebo joining Terry McLaurin, Laremy Tunsil. Very talented team in Washington. He could be the beneficiary as an MVP candidate.
Bucky, thanks for the time as always. We know you don't have much downtime left, so enjoy what you have left because we're going to be cranking it up here not too soon. So thanks for the time as always. We appreciate it.
Hey, man, thanks so much for having me on, guys.
All right, that's Bucky Brooks joining us, NFL Network analyst, as he's got Keon Coleman as his Bills breakout player for 2025. Yeah. I mean, he's got him listed with guys like Rome Odunze. I mean, that guy was a top 10 pick for the Bears last year. So, I mean, he's got him with some pretty important names. So encouraging to see that, you know, because we always wonder, like we're Bills all day, every day. So it's like, are we just a little too close to it? Like, are we seeing this right? And to see that from, you know, the outside view, I think is encouraging.
Yeah, no question. And like I said early in the show, Keon's a little bit of low-hanging fruit because he was a high draft pick, got a lot of tools, and he was starting to get you saw glimpses of it last year before the injury kind of derailed it, and then they never got the momentum back, at least him in particular. And the offense was clicking at such a high clip, ain't nobody going to fix it, you know? I mean, there's nothing to really revamp. Just give him an opportunity when you can, and that's it. So it really wasn't like his role, even at the end of the season, was defined.
It wasn't defined, you're right, because of the time he missed, it stunted his growth. Here's the thing, I think this is the other factor we have to think about too. When you look at the receivers that we anticipate will make the 53-man roster, there really isn't another guy like him. To me, that means giving him a defined role is easier. I know Joe Brady wants these guys to know all three spots across the formation, and I understand why. But to me, I think it's easier to define what his role needs to be for this team because they don't have another guy like him. They don't have another guy as tall, as strong. You know what I mean? Like, they got a lot of – they got some Smurfs,
that
are similar, like Samuel, Moore, and Shakir.
Right.
But they don't really have anybody like him. Palmer isn't a big-framed guy either. I mean, he's a little bit bigger than those other guys, but he's not, you know, broad-shouldered like Coleman.
I'll say this, too, that when you get a guy who is different in your room than the other guys in the room, you know, the coordinator is going to – what his job is to say, okay, let's do this. We're going to design this play. Because he can do this, we're going to design this play for him. And that's what you spend time doing. Those plays you saw, we saw it just a moment ago here in the studio where in Seattle, when he goes to the left side, Josh throws it, it's too low, and it bounces off the deep. Then Josh comes back, and Keon comes back to the huddle saying, throw it higher. So they throw the same play to the other side, and they score. Oh, it's that simple. Stuff like that is what a coordinator does, too. Said, hey, listen, just throw it up. You know, we had Dan Orlovsky on here when he was with the Detroit Lions, and he's the famously the quarterback who ran out the back of the end zone. But when he wasn't running out the back of the end zone, he was playing with Calvin Johnson. And he goes, I remember during the week they're saying, hey, when we get this defense and this happens, just throw it up to Calvin on the outside. And he's like, what do you mean just throw it up to him? And sure enough, he goes, you know, Calvin Johnson was like 6'6". And could outrun everybody on the field. And she goes, okay, so I did it. And he said, oh, I see. Calvin just goes up and gets it. Well, that's kind of what an offensive coordinator does. And they just tell Josh, hey, if this happens and that, go to the right backside, look for Keon, and throw it up to him. You know, it sometimes is just that simple. And but you can't do it without a guy like Keon Coleman who can just say, yeah, I hope he does. Just I hope everything goes wrong, and he just throws it up to me.
And that was against a 6'3 corner. I mean, let's not forget that in that Seattle game. Reek Woolen is a legit 6'3 corner. I mean, he's a big dude. So he can do that against that guy. Just imagine when he's going against guys that he's got 6 inches on.
Right.
Which will happen. I mean, it's not like teams are flush with...
There's a lot of 5'10 corners in the NFL.
Let's get back to some of your comments on the tweet sheet in terms of the players you expect to break out in 2025. Aaron says, Groot is finally going to get the credit he deserves this year. I think he's got the chance to be a double-digit sack guy because each year he has gotten incrementally better. You know, last year, 8 sacks, leads the team in sacks, tackles for loss, quarterback hits, and forced fumbles. I mean, he was arguably the most consistent defensive player on this roster last year. The only guy that came within a sniff of being as consistent was probably Terrell Bernard.
Yeah, and the front seven for sure. Benford was pretty good on the outside being consistent. But, yeah, I mean, that's the thing about guys like Groot. If you don't get, you know, 15 sacks, you kind of fly under the radar. But I don't think he gets enough credit because I don't think there's enough priority on casual fans and people in the media and all that. But the guys, you said it, tackles for loss. Yeah, he's really good all-around defensive end. He can play on all 3 downs, and he's effective doing all of it. Now, certainly he's not an elite pass rusher, but he's well above average. And what he does on the rest of the downs more than makes up for whatever he lacks in the pass rush. The guy is a 3-down defensive end. And, he'll, you know, because of the world we live in, you don't get credit for that.
Yeah, I hear you.
Like this right here. I mean, he's running down Brock Purdy. I mean, that counts as a sack.
Yeah, it was a sack.
But, you know, he's an effort guy as well. Hugely gifted. You know, we'll see. You're right, though. And the thing, we've talked about this in the show as well, Brownie. The one thing you have to say about Rousseau that has been consistent with him is he's never had regression. He's always on the climb.
Yeah.
Every year's a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better.
And we saw him in the cafeteria a couple of weeks ago, like right at the end of minicamp.
Yeah, he was pretty thick.
And he had like a sleeveless T-shirt on.
Yeah.
And I looked at him. I was like, how much lean muscle mass did you add to those arms and shoulders? And he just kind of laughed and he said, I'm trying to look like you guys. I said, okay, now get the hell out of here because you're at the different end of the gene pool, buddy. Yeah. So he wouldn't answer my question, but I kind of feel like he's added 6 to 8 pounds of lean muscle mass, you know, through his chest and his shoulders.
And his upper body.
Bigger, stronger. So I'm curious to see what that brings along, you know. And look, the reason they liked Greg Rousseau was because while he was short on experience as a 1-year starter at Miami, he was long on physical gifts. And I think the most important thing that they liked about him was his work ethic. I mean, this guy is working all the time. And I think that the improvements we've seen in his game with each passing year is a testament to that.
One of the other things they did with him at the U was in his year that he started in passing situations, he was down inside.
Yeah.
And his versatility and willingness to just, you know, do different things. He's never been a one-trick pony. Like I say, he's a 3-down guy. Even in college, they put him, you know, at different spots, and he excelled. He's one of the guys, too. Remember, he took the 2020 season off. He chose not to play and to go into the draft just on what he did his
COVID
junior year,
right,
or the COVID year. So that's one of the, you know, the problems they had in evaluating back then anyway. But yeah, Rousseau is a good one. You'd love to see it. He's been consistent, solid. You know, everything you wanted except the sack. You know, you always want one of these guys that's got like 13 sacks after 14 games.
And
you know,
feels like he's been here forever. He just turned 25 in April. He's 25.
Aren't they the ones? Is he the one they drafted when he was like?
He was like 21.
Yeah.
You're thinking of Tremaine Edmonds.
Tremaine Edmonds was like 19 20. When they drafted him, and he turned 20 after the draft. But Groot's the same way. Young.
Yeah.
Really young.
Right now, I'm really excited to have Brad May back on the show. For me, it's been a long time since talking to Brad. Of course, no introduction needed here. Over 1,000 games in the league. One of the most famous goals in Sabres history, if not number one. Brad, Mike Schoep here. How's life?
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. What's new with you?
Hey, that was a really nice introduction. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
It was many years ago, 1993, that goal. But above and beyond that, my 7.5, 8 seasons I was with the Sabres were truly memorable. And I was actually in Buffalo the last couple of days and missed my friends there for sure.
Yeah, you never forget your first, right, Brad? I mean, this is the organization you started with and many great memories the fans have too.
Yeah, you know what? It was an incredible place for me to start my career. I'm sure I've told this story many times, even on the air with the Sabres, but I was such a lucky guy. I got selected to play in Niagara Falls for the Niagara Falls Thunder when I was a teenager, of course, and then I was drafted 25, 30 minutes down the road to the Buffalo Sabres. So I felt like I was a semi-local boy, exactly how Jerry Meehan announced it at the draft floor. I was given a really, really neat opportunity to kind of, you know, immerse myself in the, obviously, Western New York, but the Niagara Peninsula, 30 minutes away, made it much easier to, you know, make the team, but also make that jump from junior hockey to the NHL.
Yeah, I get it. It wasn't such a foreign thing, right? I mean, you could go to places you knew. You grew up in Toronto anyway, or near Toronto. So I think that would be a pretty good advantage for a young player. Buffalo has long been a town where, I mean, hockey people, so many over the years, have made their homes here. And I just wonder, like, what it is for you about this area that on the occasion of Give 716 that makes it so special to so many.
Well, number one, if I could just speak of myself for a moment, I live just north of Toronto, so I'm not too far away. I'm on the highway right now, but because I left Buffalo. But yeah, if I wasn't living north of Toronto where I grew up, I could see myself living in Western New York, right in Buffalo. I mean, it feels like home. The cool part about 716 and, of course, the Day of Giving and through the organizations in Buffalo and all the 501c3 charities, there's so many that are underserved and maybe just don't get in front of, you know, the masses. What an unbelievable endeavor from Mr. and Mrs. Pegula down, from the Bills, the Sabres, the Bandits, obviously just the community itself at large. When I left this morning, I was at Key Bank in Williamsville. Mm-hmm. I looked at the total there at about $860,000, which I imagine that's going to be eclipsed and going to go well into the $1 million threshold. It just speaks volumes of the community, obviously the people in Buffalo, Western New York, and understanding that there's so many wonderful charities and giving people, philanthropic people that, you know what, they give of themselves, and to have the support of their community is amazing. Last night I was at the draft room right beside the arena, mm-hmm. and there was a couple hundred people there. It was really, really cool. Obviously saw football fans, lacrosse fans, hockey fans, and, you know, a lot of this money is desperately needed in those certain sectors. And I'll just give you one quick story, Mike, if you mm-hmm. don't mind.
Please.
I met a woman last night who started a charity, and they give flowers and gift baskets to widowers. Mm. You know, so like first thing you think about is Roswell Park and children with cancer, and you go down the path, there's so many people that need love and support. And this woman came up with this idea that on Valentine's Day they give these baskets and flowers to widowers, and they tied it into the school system where they have the children, you know, write these Valentine cards. And it's amazing. Puts a smile on someone's face 5-10 years after losing their loved one, that, you know what, they know that they're supported and they're loved in their community. And I actually had a tear in my eye when I gave her a hug last night, because I was like, these are things you don't hear of unless you're actually, you know, amongst those people, or, you know, it's hard for these people to get their, their story and the word out. And this 716 Day of Giving, which is wonderful, enables and has given these people an opportunity, which is fantastic.
Very cool and very well said about the area, and the great point about not just the charities you hear about all the time, not that they're not worthy. With Brad May on the Western Hotline, this is Mike Shope. One hockey-related question I wanted to ask you from your experience. I mean, you played for so long, and you also played in like all corners of North America and then into broadcasting here and out west also. We're at a point where, I mean, Vegas won, Florida has won two, Seattle, Utah. I mean, there's just we would maybe have a tendency to put down certain markets around here, thinking of how loyal this fan base is, you know, Florida with empty buildings or Carolina. And that's very different now. And I wonder what your perspective might be when it comes to this, because the Sabres have some challenges when it comes to recruiting players. And it just seems like the competition is obviously deeper and, you know, better.
Yeah. You know what? So we had this conversation actually this morning, Tim Connolly and myself, and along with Marty Biron and Brian Duff, they did their show from the KeyBank, the branch that we were at. Mm-hmm. We had a conversation basically talking about, obviously, you know, there's the zero state taxes, there's the different regions in the country. Of course, you got Canada, you know, you're dealing with provincial governments and state governments and all these different things. The bottom line is winning begets winning. So, you know, it's the chicken and egg theory. Is it the tax, you know, structures of these different states and cities that, you know, are obviously more advantageous for players? That's true. Climate is definitely a difference, a differentiator. But at the end of the day, hockey players want to play hockey and they want to win hockey games and they want to be part of a vaunting program that actually produces wins and certainly a lot of excitement and fun. So for Buffalo, listen, we know, the people that are listening to this show know that Western New York, certainly Buffalo Sabres, they've had a tough run. They haven't been a good team winning-wise for quite some time, and that's going to hurt them. If they can find the way to turn the corner with the talent and the players they do have, find that spirit and resolve to go win more hockey games, they won't be a problem recruiting players to come play in Buffalo. And the Buffalo Bills possibly going to another Super Bowl run, all this stuff, Buffalo's an incredible place. It definitely gets overlooked at times when you start looking at all these other factors, but the bottom line is hockey players want to play on a good hockey team, have an opportunity to win and compete, and I see that happening. I see that being such an opportunity for the Buffalo Sabres and certain these young players. Grab the bull, you know, bull by the horns and get after it. I'm obviously somewhat biased. I love my life in Buffalo, and there's no question there's competition with other markets, but the game of hockey's grown. The talent level is absolutely the best it's ever been. And somehow management and coaching, obviously in Buffalo, have to figure out a way with the players they have to go and win hockey games. If they do that, it'll take care of itself.
Right. Just as it has at other times in the Sabres history. You know, like what those two incredible seasons, 06 and 07, where did that come from? You know, like they were just out of bankruptcy and it felt somewhat like this, where like maybe they could have been moved, Brad, you know, in those years for a minute. But they did not have, you know, put to them super high expectations out of the lockout, and they killed it. So that's that. You can always be optimistic because sometimes you just don't see it coming.
Well, and the whole point there is, and I recognize why we're talking today about obviously 716 Day and raising my charity and the great community of Western New York. Bottom line is you got to win hockey games. If you win hockey games, that takes care of itself. The excitement will be back in the building. That excitement will bring more fans, more money, and more eyeballs to the product. And the bottom line is they got Lindy Ruff, who's had success in Buffalo as a player and as a coach and manager, and he's there, and he's got his team, and he's got to find a way to beat. There's 31 other teams that want to beat Buffalo's ass every day that they play them. And sometimes, over the last 10, 15 years, it's probably been an easier night for some of those teams, mm-hmm. playing against the Buffalo Sabres. Some way, somehow, I don't know, go back to maybe, and I, this is me being a little bit biased, but go back to 1995, 96 when Ted Nolan was our coach. We were the hardest working team in hockey, or certainly branded as that. We didn't end up making the playoffs that season, the last year at the odd. But you know what? We are damn exciting. We brought a different element, which obviously is not in the game today, but we had a heart and a spirit and in the world becoming a Cassock.
Yeah.
You know, backstopping our team. But like, and that helps. But at the end of the day, you got to find a way. It's not just about skating, shooting, and beautiful hockey plays. It's about taking the will of, you know, away from your opposition. It's about making any night in the bank a difficult night to play.
Brad May with us.
And of course, the talent level, right? I mean, at the end of the day, they got to win hockey games. They do that, I'll be a fan. I'll be driving down from Toronto all the time to
yes.
come watch.
I didn't mean to step on you there. The connection was breaking up, so I wasn't sure I still had you. By the way, I should probably not mention 06-07 without also mentioning that you were on the cup winner that year in Anaheim. That had to be memories you won't forget.
Oh, dude, it was a dream come true, of course. 16 years in the NHL at that point for me, and I got traded at the trade deadline from the Colorado Avalanche, and fortunately for myself, I landed in Anaheim with a great team. And through that playoff run, I was actually had my fingers crossed that but Buffalo was going to beat Ottawa in the conference final in the East. And Anaheim, had we, you know, which we did, we beat Detroit. I would have faced against the Buffalo Sabres, and that would have been absolutely amazing. Unfortunately, Ottawa played too well, and Buffalo found themselves in some injury trouble, and
right.
and we didn't get that chance. But winning the Stanley Cup and just being part of a team that did that, everybody in Buffalo, I swear to God, if Buffalo ever gets to this point, and I hope it's sooner than later, we're all going to have an absolute time of our lives celebrating and cheering that team on, because it's the best place to be as a hockey player, and I'm certainly sure as a fan to cheer your team on at that level at that time of the year. So my fingers are crossed for the Buffalo Sabres.
One thing I remember about that season, 06-07, I remember a lot of things, but from being in here with Bulldog, the 5-06 season, the Sabres were so close. 06-07, they win the President's Trophy, but Bulldog kept saying, Anaheim is scary. Like, they were, and, you know, Tim Connolly missing almost that entire season, coming back for the playoffs. You know, think about how that could have been, you know, did add to their depth. But, man, I think of Bulldog when I think of those Ducks, because he was just like, I don't know. This is about,
you know,
it's about the cup, and I don't know.
The interesting part, again, listen, we had our time. Time does pass. The Anaheim Ducks, although we were emblazoned on the Stanley Cup and our team and our names, and it's wonderful. I would say the closest team to be the Florida Panthers, who have obviously won the last two Stanley Cups, were the Anaheim Ducks in 2007, a team that actually could beat you in many different fashions. They were tougher than everybody they played. They played tougher. You had a buy-in from the whole group. Your star players were tough. We had Tammy Salani, who grinded it out. We had Chris Pronger and Scott Niedermeyer. At the end of the day, you need superstars, but then you also need an emerging young core. And that group was yeah. Corey Perry, Ryan Getzlaff, Chris Kunitz, who goes on to win four Stanley Cups.
Wow.
We had tough guys in George Parros and Sean Thornton. You know what? When I look at the Florida Panthers, the way they beat their team, you know, the teams they played, they took the will away from the Tampa Bay Lightning, the Toronto Maple Leafs, rolled over Carolina, which I didn't see coming. And then, of course, David, for the most part, Florida was a good team. And you know what? If I'm a Buffalo Sabre fan, I want to get some of that spirit in my lineup.
Yeah, that's a good comp. Dustin Penner, another one from that Ducks team you were on. Big guys. Well, thank you, Brad. It's great to talk to you again, and appreciate, on behalf of everybody involved, your efforts in helping give 716 Day come off.
Well, the coolest part about it, Mike, is you can't do it alone. You do it team and as an organization, and I swear to God, the community of Western New York is second to none, and it was beautiful to be a part of it, but it takes many of us to show up and do this stuff, and of course, it takes all the people that are so kind and generous to donate. So I really do hope that the 716 day is a success and has been, and really, really thrilled that I was asked to be part of it.
Very nice. Thanks, Brad. Enjoyed talking to you as always.
Take care. All the best to you guys.
Thank you. Brad May with us. Give716.org is the site, and you can pick which charities you want to support.